This is talking with Carl Jansky's brother, Cyril Moreau Jansky.
No, I beg your pardon, C. Moreau.
C. Moreau Jansky, at his home in Washington on 29 December 73. And for the sake of the other recording, this is Woody Sullivan interviewing. Right, well, could you tell me about the helping Carl get hired at Bell Labs?
I must give a little background with respect to my own experiences.
Okay.
Then it happens that in the years immediately preceding 1920, after I had graduated and obtained my, after I had graduated from, in physics from the University of Wisconsin, I went to New York to work at 463 West Street, which was the laboratory which at that time was the preceded, was the laboratory of the Bell System, which later became Bell Telephone Laboratories.
Was the name changed the same time as they moved out to...
No, I think it... I'm not sure whether it changed. I think it changed before they moved, but I cannot be sure of that. But it so happened then, and I think perhaps I've got to... Although I don't particularly like to do this, perhaps I should. And this may be of interest in connection with what followed. In January 1920, I became a member of the faculty of the Department of Electrical Engineering of the University of Minnesota. And at that time, when I went to the University of Minnesota, most of the electrical engineering courses were in power engineering. And it became my duty to try to build the courses in radio engineering, and in the conjunction with another professor, Professor Swenson, who handled telephone and telegraph work, to build what in effect was the communication part of the Department of Electrical Engineering of the University of Minnesota. It is true that in those days, courses in power electrical engineering were required if you wished to take communication engineering either in radio or in telephone and telegraph work. It became necessary to take elective courses. For instance, all of my courses in radio engineering were taught in the senior year and in postgraduate years at the University of Minnesota. Now, prior to this time, the Bell System was very tight with all of its work. They were very tight with respect to the experimental work going on in their laboratories. The result was that students in electrical engineering and physics knew very little about what was going on in the communication field.
By tight, you mean not publishing it? So.
That's right. Mm. And it was largely for patent reasons that this was true. And this may seem a peculiar background for this, but I think you'll see its connection as we go on.
Okay.
I recall specifically about 1922, I think it was, that engineers from the Bell System, having decided they had to secure more men for research and development and work in the Bell System, were out trying to hire graduates from the electrical engineering. And two of them, including a Mr. Parker, showed up at the University of Wisconsin, and they were interviewing students who would graduate in my office.
Right.
And I recall one man we had who was a superb student, but he'd never taken a course in anything above 60 cycles. So when Parker tried to hire him, he said, "Oh, I'm not interested in going in the communication field. You have no problems there." But Parker just sat back and gasped. Well, when he left, I admit, I gave these two men a lecture, having been in the Bell system myself.
Yeah.
I said, if you want to get graduates of universities into the communication field, you've got to give them some picture of what is going on in this field, because graduates will not go into fields they know nothing about.
Right.
And they know what's going on in the power field. Now, I do not know to what extent my talk with Parker was responsible, but I think maybe it had something to do with it, but their own experiences in trying to hire graduates of electrical engineering departments had as much as anything. But almost overnight, the philosophy of the Bell system changed. First, they held some conferences of 1 to 2 weeks duration in New York at the laboratories, invited those of us who were professors and teachers down at their expense to see what's going on.
Amazing.
Then they also, to each of the universities, and I do not know how many, but I know that we at the University of Minnesota received several thousand dollars worth of communication measuring equipment with instructions and information as to how to use it in our telephone, telegraph, and radio laboratories. Now, as a result of this, I became quite well acquainted with a number of rather high-level people in Bell Telephone Laboratories, the names of some of whom I will mention a little later. And when Carl was not a well man as a student, he had, I believe, some small symptoms of what's known as Bright's disease. But he graduated in physics from the University of Wisconsin, as I had. The time of his graduation is given in the papers which you have. And I knew that he had applied for a position on his graduation with Bell Telephone Laboratories. They were frankly a little hesitant to hire him because of his physical background. I think I may have mentioned some of this in some of the papers I've written. Well, I've put up quite an argument with some of my friends, whose names I cannot name for a minute, in the Bell system, that after all, he was a good student, he had good results, and Bell finally hired him. I don't think Bell ever regretted that they hired him. That is that phase of it.
Right.
So going on from there, because of my own background in the field of radio, I found myself involved particularly in the Hoover conferences for the purpose which Secretary of Commerce called in 1922, 23, 24, and 25, their purpose being to try to frame new legislation to regulate the rapidly developing field of radio broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
This brought me east very frequently for these conferences, as did my consulting business, which began to develop on the side at the University of Minnesota. And in connection with this, I actually had these conferences, which had many men from industry and government, had many conferences with my friends in the Bell Laboratories, in the Radio Corporation of America, and other radio companies. And of course, I began to follow Carl's work then, because I would visit with them. And one summer, I've forgotten the exact summer, while I was at the University of Minnesota, I either spent my summers working in the Bureau of Standards with Dr. Dellinger in the Bureau of Standards mm-hmm. Radio Laboratory, but one summer I spent with the Radio Signal Laboratory of the Signal Corps of the United States Army, which is at Camp Vale, New Jersey, not too far from Red Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw something of Carl's work and what he was doing there.
You know, he was hired in 1928 or something like this.
1928, yes.
This was just about the time that you ceased being a professor.
That's the time I ceased being a professor and started my own consulting business here.
Yeah.
But then I used to see a good deal of Carl and his family. They're not too far from here.
Right.
And saw what he was doing. But the man who really, to the best of my knowledge, as much as anyone, understood the importance of what Carl was doing, was our father, who, because of his scientific background and because of what he heard of it in letters from Bell Telephone Laboratories, from Carl,
mm-hmm.
Was the first man that I know of who first said, this is one of the most important scientific discoveries in a long period of time.
This was after he had established that it was extraterrestrial.
That's right, that's right. Now, you have copies of all of Carl's original papers. It happened that as a member of the board of directors of the Institute of Radio Engineers in 1933, the year before I was president, I presided at the Institute of Radio Engineers conference, at which Carl in Washington gave one of the very early disclosures of his reception of radio signals from a fixed point in space.
Right.
Which, as you know, later proved to be the center of the Milky Way.
That was his second paper, I guess.
It was his second paper.
The one where he established that it was a fixed point
in
space.
That's right. That's right. That was the first, I believe it was the first one in which he spoke about this fixed point in space.
And what was the reception of this? Of this paper?
Like so many scientific discoveries, and this could be said about a large number of them, the importance of this discovery was not universally recognized. But this is not unusual.
Right.
This is why I mentioned the fact that I think our father was one of the first to, at least mm-hmm. one of the first that I ever saw emphasize it. I know that he is the man who got me particularly interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl was a very modest man. He was not aggressive. And there were those in the Bell system who couldn't see an immediate practical application of this thing, which is not difficult to understand.
Right.
I would say that it only at about the time shortly before Carl died that people really began to mm-hmm. be interested and recognize the importance of this basic discovery.
Right. After the war, right. Exactly.
That's right.
But let me ask you before we get on about the session at which you were present when he gave this paper. Can you remember at all the reaction? I mean, did everyone believe what he was saying, first of all?
Oh, I think everyone believed it, but I don't recall that anyone particularly was terribly impressed as to its importance.
Right. It was just another paper then, really.
Just another paper at that time. That is true. But this is not unusual with respect to scientific discoveries.
Right. No, that's true.
Finally, haven't time. I can't pull any other examples out of my mind at the moment, but I know I've read many of them, and you have too.
No, that's right.
Uh-huh. Is this what you want?
Yeah, that's just, exactly. Now, okay, so you were saying that he was not an aggressive sort.
No, he was not. I do know that his wife Alice thought that he ought to receive more reception. I don't more recognition for it than he did.
Mm-hmm.
After all, there were articles in the New York Times about it, and there was even a radio broadcast about it. Of course, this was in the days before television, but there was even a radio broadcast program about it. Today, we would, of course, have a tape recording of it, but then recordings were harder to make in those days.
I wonder if there still is one existing. I want to look for one, because they must have had one to make the recording.
Well, let's see.
To make the broadcast, I mean.
I don't even know. I don't even know which radio station did it. We'll have to see.
Well, I think it was CBS. I think I've seen that somewhere.
CBS, wow.
And I think they actually gave a recording of the hiss, you know, and the announcer said, listen to the hiss of the universe or something.
Well, I'm sorry, Frank Stanton is still not chairman of the board of or president of CBS, because he's a very close friend of mine.
Well, we can talk about that afterwards, maybe.
Sure,
yeah,
but
okay.
There are people up there at CBS. If it's CBS, it would be very... I would not be at all surprised if there was not a recording of it. Too bad.
But, now, what do you know of what Carl wanted to do? Did he want to follow up more than he was able to?
Yes, he did want to follow it. He did want to follow it. But, let's see, this would be in the 30s, wouldn't it?
Right. His last paper to do with this was in 35, in which he went back over his year's worth of data, and he came up with a few more interesting things about the width of the galactic plane and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time already, he wasn't able to take new data, apparently. He was just looking at his old data.
They put him on other work. You see, originally his work was, at that time, of course, as you know the background, Bell System was very much interested in transatlantic radio telephony.
Right.
And Carl's job was to study static in its origin. And this is why he got into this field, is because it's the application of that.
Right.
Static was one of the limiting factors on transatlantic and transoceanic high frequency radio telephony. Well, of course, it wouldn't bother us now, because since that time they've developed the underwater cable and also these satellites for that purpose.
But what can you remember about, I mean, do you know of any records of any kind, maybe memos he might have written about wanting to do more, or proposals of any kind?
I think the best source of information on that would be his widow.
Okay.
Very frankly. I will look through some of my correspondence with my father, but that will take a little time. And I may find some reference to it.
Yeah.
I know that Carl did give some consideration. That is, I think this is correct, and yet I don't want to say it without it. There was some thought that he thought a little bit about leaving. I believe this is correct,
mm-hmm.
but I will not check it. That he wanted to leave and join the faculty of some university so he could continue his studies, because he did want to continue his studies.
Of the extraterrestrial.
Yeah,
but
I believe it's a safe statement that until Bell fully recognized its importance, there was this gap And this is not unusual. Now, one of the men, as I've told you, who has always been a very strong supporter of Carl's work, was Ralph Pound, later director of Bell Laboratories, now retired. And I got to know him very well because I served with him on the board of directors of the Institute of Radio Engineers. If I remember correctly, no, he was not a member of my board in 1934, but we used to see a good deal of each other. The year I was president, 34.
Well, he was vice president at the time of during the 30s. Bowen was
vice president of
Bell
Lab. Yes.
And yet still, even though he was in favor, apparently he wasn't able to...
Well, they had a lot of problems, but after all, Bell Labs, you're bound to have, and things of that kind.
I mean, it is a commercial company, of course.
Of course. Yeah. But one can't give too much credit to Bell Laboratories for the things that they have done in this and other fields.
Right.
Look at what they did in the development of the transistor.
Exactly. And they've done more in radio astronomy, too.
Oh, yes.
And Penzias and Wilson...
Yes.
10 years ago. And
You're more familiar with that than I am, I'm sorry to say.
But how long did Carl work at Bell Labs? Right up until he died?
Up until he was working there when he died.
But there are only about two or three papers that I've been able to find. The last one is 44 or something, that he published. So did he get more into administration in his later years? Or?
Well, I think he was working more on other scientific problems, but just what he was working on, very frankly, I don't know.
You think he might have been published somewhere else other than the proceedings of the IRE, perhaps?
No, I think we've got all of his publications in the Bell Laboratories record and these things, too. Those are the things.
That's it, okay. Yeah.
That's it, yes.
And then...
I'm sorry I didn't have time to do a more thorough research job before you talked to me.
No, that's quite all right. And when he finally died, was it of the same disease, Bright's disease?
Yes, it was. Yes, I was with the family in Red Bank when he died.
And I guess he was never totally well during this whole time, is that correct?
I wouldn't say that he was not, because Carl was quite a tennis player.
And I see.
And he was a... When it came to ping pong or table tennis, he was the champion of the county. So he, I would say that his health was good, but some of those things, you know, you don't show up until later. But
right.
Oh, yes, for many years, his health was very good, but I have no doubt that his earlier illness had some influence on his death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no question about that. As he was a... And he was quite a skater, too. He played hockey.
I see.
Was a member of the University of Wisconsin hockey team. So he was quite athletic. As I say, in Red Bank and in New Jersey, he played tennis and ping pong, or table tennis, if you want to call it.
Right.
Ping pong's a trade name.
Do you know if he knew about Grote Reber's work? I suppose he must have known about it. But
yes. And Grote Reber was one of the early men who early recognized the importance.
Yeah, certainly.
Of Carl's work. Oh, yes. Matter of fact, if my memory is correct, and I think it is, Grote Reber visited with Carl. By the way, he's still living.
Oh, he's still very much alive, yes.
Well, you get a lot of things from him. Have you interviewed him?
Not yet. I definitely want to, though. Right.
Yeah. Where is he?
In Ohio.
Is he Ohio? Is he at the...
No, he gets most of his money from research corporations.
Second.
That is the interview with Carl Jansky's brother at his home in Washington, D.C. on 29 December 73.